What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Laura Delano. Laura is an ex-psychiatric patient, and in 2010, she withdrew from five different psychiatric drugs that she was taking for more than 12 years. Laura is the co-founder of the Inner Compass Initiative and its Withdrawal Project, which is an online hub for psychiatric drug tapering and withdrawal and for community building. So welcome to Madness Radio, Laura Delano.
Thanks, Will. It's great to be here.
So, Laura, your work is so important in the world, and I'm really excited about the new Inner Compass Initiative and the Withdrawal Project that you've just recently launched. I really want to encourage people to check this work out, and it's great having you on the show because years ago, you were also a guest on Madness Radio, and it's awesome having you back, and I want to encourage people to check out your other Madness Radio show, which is available on the archives on the internet and through podcasts. And you've been continuing to do this withdrawal work, and you're offering a really important resource to people. Maybe we could just sort of give us a general summary for people who haven't heard the previous show. Tell us, what was your story? How did you get on all these different medications, and how did you end up withdrawing from them?
Well, my story began back in 1997 when I was 13 years old and basically had this profound crisis of self that I won't get into the details of here, but what I ended up beginning to do was act out at home. I had a lot of anger, rage, irritability, great despair. I was cutting myself. I was thinking about death. And eventually my parents just grew terrified because I kept it all together at school, but I'd come home and I would fall apart in these ways. And so understandably, as you know, so many parents are taught to do in our society, they reached the point where they said, my God, we're so worried about Laura. We don't know what to do. We should send her to a professional for help. And
you were, were 13 years old when this happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was 13 and I was first sent to a family therapist, but eventually she referred me to a psychiatrist because I was too, you know, serious of a case. And that psychiatrist in the first appointment, you know, I'd never met this woman before. She knew nothing about me other than these, you know, brief descriptions of my behaviors at home. And she proceeded to tell me at the end of that session that my anger and irritability were symptoms of this thing called mania, and my despair and self-injury and urge to die were symptoms of depression, and that I had a condition called bipolar disorder and that there was no cure for it. I'd be living with it for the rest of my life. But the good news was that there were medications to help me manage, and with therapy, I could find my way. And there I was at that point, I was 14, and it just ripped me apart inside to be told that essentially I was fundamentally defective.
Just to get a sense, so when you say you're angry and you had a lot of intense emotions, what exactly was going on in the house? Because there's sort of a question of like, well, maybe this was pretty normal behavior for a 13-year-old girl. What exactly were you doing that was so extreme? You mentioned that you were cutting yourself, and what kinds of things was the anger all about?
I mean, you know, I was cursing and screaming a lot. I would get physical, you know, I'd push family members. I'd get incredibly aggressive and, you know, like in their face, and I'd slam doors, and I was just this live wire of rage, essentially. And, you know, I think maybe I was an intense version of what happens to many adolescents, or maybe that's totally normal and lots of adolescents do those things. But I mean, it makes sense to me that my parents just eventually didn't know what to do because it was very overwhelming for them. And it happened so suddenly because this crisis I'd had was a very acute thing. So they just didn't understand why I changed almost overnight.
And so just looking back, I want to hear the rest of the story, but just looking back, why do you think you were so angry? What was going on?
Well, I see now that it was just this profoundly meaningful and important thing that was happening to me. Really, that crisis I'd had was realizing that I didn't know who I was, that I was this girl who was programmed to get good grades and to play sports and to be successful and accomplished. And it dawned on me that I'm just this robot programmed to do these things, but who am I actually? I don't even have a real self. I'm controlled by these broader forces. And so I see now it was like a profound, like I almost had a transcendence of self and ego. Like it was a spiritual crisis that I'd had, because all of this happened in front of a bathroom mirror where I lost touch. I had an out of body experience. The only way I could make sense of that was through anger, to basically say, I'm being controlled by all of these forces beyond me and screw them. This is the only thing I can do to assert my independence is to get angry.
And so 13, do you think you were entering puberty at that time? Was that part of what was going on with all this anger and this self-questioning of your identity and your independence?
I think so. I mean, I definitely, a big part of what I was grappling with was just feeling disconnected from my body and having very intense emotions and very intense psychological experiences. And so, yeah, I mean, I have to think that a lot was happening biologically within me, in addition to, you know, the broader like socio-political forces that were at play.
And nobody around you just said, actually, maybe you don't have bipolar disorder and need meds. Maybe this is actually just normal and your parents are the ones who need help in dealing with it.
I don't remember ever having anyone convey that message to me, but I myself initially resisted the diagnosis and basically said, F you. I don't think I actually said that out loud to her, but that's what I felt internally. And so I was able in high school to somewhat avoid internalizing that diagnosis. I mean, I definitely, it affected me profoundly. And I always carried with me this idea that, you know, the world thought I was, like these people beyond me thought I was broken. But I didn't buy into it fully. I bought into the idea that I was depressed. And I also was having struggles with like eating and body image. And so I knew I also had like a so-called eating disorder, but bipolar, no, I rejected that for a few years. It wasn't until I was 18 that I really bought into that. So I was able to kind of tell myself, like, you're not bipolar. It's the world around you that's messed up. But that didn't last long.
So you got the diagnosis, but you resisted the diagnosis, but you were taking meds at 14.
Well, the psychiatrist put me on Depakote, which is classified as a mood stabilizer, and Prozac, which of course is classified as an antidepressant. But I hated the drugs. I hated what they represented, which to me was, you know, the world thinks I'm broken. So I did avoid taking them whenever I could. Like I have these vivid memories of like trying to dissolve the capsule under hot water in my hand, and I'd hide them in my closet. And so I didn't take them regularly between the ages of 14 and 18. I took them on and off.
And then what happened? At some point you did switch and identify as bipolar and start agreeing with that diagnosis and start taking the meds regularly?
Yeah, that happened when I was 18. And basically through high school, you know, there I was simultaneously so acutely aware of how absurd these stories were that I'd bought into about what it means to be successful and accomplished, you know, getting good grades and all of these things. I simultaneously knew that it was all this absurd thing that didn't really have any meaning, but I also didn't know how to escape it. I didn't know how to extricate myself from these boxes that I was in. And so I ended up finding my way to Harvard, which, you know, I somehow was still holding as this pinnacle. Like if I could just get to a place like Harvard, maybe I'll realize I'm wrong all along. And actually this is what will make me happy and what will make me feel good about myself. And so I worked really hard through high school to get there, and I got there, and right away it became very apparent that nothing felt any different, that I still didn't know who I was. I still wanted to die. I still felt like I didn't fit into the world. And so I really spun out that fall. Like, I didn't sleep a lot. I did a lot of drugs. I was like doing lots of very self-destructive things. And a few months in, I just, that voice of that first psychiatrist telling me I was bipolar kept, it just got louder and louder and louder until I realized there must be something wrong with me. She must have been right, because I've done everything I meant to do to succeed and be happy, and I just want to die. And that was the point that I totally embraced this idea of being sick and bipolar. And I started to do lots of therapy and take lots of drugs. And the next 10 years, that was like who I was and like what I did was be a psychiatric patient.
And it sounds like that didn't help either, actually.
Yeah. Amazingly, even though every day of every month of every year for those next 10 years, I was so full of faith in all my doctors and these pills that they were going to help me, they never actually did. And with each passing year, you know, I would find myself on another drug, you know, like two mood stabilizers and an antidepressant and a benzodiazepine and an antipsychotic. Just the list grew over the years. And simultaneously, I became less able to participate in the world. Like, I did manage to graduate from college. I had to take a year off to go into the hospital. But I somehow managed to graduate. But after that, I couldn't hold down jobs. I couldn't maintain relationships. I was really spinning out into struggles with alcohol. I just was a mess. My physical health was horrible. And the desire to die just kept growing bigger and bigger. The deeper I went into the mental health system, and eventually, you know, suicide came to me as the only logical solution I had.
So it sounds like as you were taking these medications and they weren't working, the doctor's solution was just to give you more medications?
Yeah. I mean, they told me that I had so-called treatment-resistant bipolar disorder, which basically I took to mean you are so sick that even our best medicines aren't helping you. And so, yeah, it was always more meds, more program, you know, more day treatment or outpatient programs or more hospitalizations. It was, no one ever said, you know, maybe these like five drugs you're taking aren't helping you. And nor did that thought cross my mind until it did, and everything changed.
When did that change? When did you start saying, wait a second, maybe I'm not this bipolar sick person that I'm being told I am?
Things started to change for me in 2010. And I had three different experiences that I see now began to dislodge that faith I was carrying in the mental health system. And each of these three experiences actually involved encounters with psychiatric force and coercion. And, you know, up until 2010, at least beginning when I was 18, I was always a good compliant patient who did exactly what my doctor said. And, you know, I kept mood diaries and I reported my symptoms and I checked myself into the hospital and I took my meds as prescribed. And so I'd never come up against this before. And basically I was forced into the hospital by two security guards who gave me the so-called choice of going voluntarily or involuntarily. Then on that unit, I was made to take a drug that I didn't want to take to keep me from drinking alcohol, which is a whole nother story, but I was trying to quit drinking at that point. And that was the first time I realized, oh my God, they have the right to make me put something in my body that I don't want. And then the third experience was when a therapist called the police on me when I slept through an appointment with her because I was so sedated to do a so-called wellness check. Luckily, they didn't actually arrive. It's a bit of a long story as to why, but those three experiences forced me up against the force inherent in the mental health system. And it really, it dislodged the unquestioning reliance I'd previously had on them, because I realized they own me. They own my right to fresh air. They own my body. They own my privacy. And so I wasn't, you know, like, get me out of here right now or anything like that, but I was questioning. And at that point I happened upon a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whittaker, which I know you're well aware of course, Will. And basically the thesis of this book is that if you look at what the science is telling us about the long-term use of psychiatric drugs, you see that we've actually been told a story about their safety and effectiveness that is far from true. And so suddenly I was faced up against the realization that, like, what if it hasn't been treatment-resistant mental illness all these years that's been making my life fall more and more apart? Like, what if the treatment itself has actually been at the heart of that? And that was my aha moment that really propelled me on this journey out.
And then how did you get off the medications?
I am a good example of how not to taper off in a way that's safe and very careful. I had no idea what I was doing. I don't even know if I knew that withdrawal was a thing, you know, and my psychopharmacologist certainly didn't. It took me a couple of months to get him to agree to help me. And he didn't actually help me in any kind of emotional support way. He just like agreed to let me do it. And so, yeah, I came off of 5 psychiatric drugs that I was on at the time. It was lithium, Lamictal, Abilify, Effexor, and Ativan.
Wow, you were really over medicated. All those different drugs are just doing all kinds of different things different directions.
It was so many different drugs doing so many different things. And I came off of them in 5 months, which is incredibly fast, basically cold turkey. But I at the time, all I cared about was getting these drugs out of my system as fast as possible so that I could figure out who I might be off of them. That was kind of the driving the thing I was going towards. And so I lacked solid information around just how risky and potentially dangerous it is to come off of these powerful drugs so quickly. And I ended up getting off of them was the hardest thing I ever did. And it's hard.
especially if you're taking a benzodiazepine, that's the one that if you come off of it abruptly, you can trigger seizures or even sudden death, cardiac arrest, and can come from benzo withdrawal. And then lithium, coming off lithium, suddenly a lot of people will just have a psychotic episode if they stop taking their lithium. They won't be able to sleep, and then they're in a manic state.
Yeah. And I see now that I was surrounded by so much privilege and support that even though I was quite spun out in many ways, but I was very insulated and protected. And so, you know, I was living with extended family for the first year, so I didn't have to pay rent. I could just kind of hide myself away in their house and lie.
Because now you really were sick because mm-hmm. the drugs were making you sick.
Mm-hmm. And I was in so much physical pain. I had these horrible gastrointestinal issues, chronic headaches, like really strained, like disgusting, huge boils erupting on my neck and my face and my back, and strange smells coming out of like the skin on my chest. Like I just had such agonizing physical pain. And my mental and emotional state was just like this uncontrollable roller coaster. I was like a Jekyll and Hyde. You know, if I lived in a different set of circumstances, if I didn't have the privacy I had, if I was under the watchful eyes of the police or of other surveillance authorities, if I didn't have family by my side to help me, you know, have a shelter and food, I don't know what would have happened, but I was just so lucky. I got basically anything that a person might need to survive psychiatric drug withdrawal, I had.
And if you didn't have that, you might have just been stayed stuck in the system in a kind of revolving door, which is what happens to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And then, so a lot of what we're talking about, you go into more detail in your other Madness Radio interview that I, again, encourage people to check out in the Madness Radio archives. But what are some of the things that you've learned about the whole healing process that maybe you would do differently? Or what are some of the more recent things that you learned looking back on this whole experience of coming off all those meds abruptly?
I'd say at year 3 off, in between years 3 and 4, I began to really come alive. My cognitive functioning returning, my metabolism figuring itself out. So the 50 extra pounds that I'd gained on the drugs began to just fall off. Like, and I finally found like the body that I was meant to be in that I couldn't be in. I began to feel increasingly more connected to my body, to my creativity, to my sexuality. My emotions began to like reintegrate. So even though they're still very intense today, I'm not at their mercy in the way that I was. Just at year 3, a lot began to change. And it's just been this gift ever since. And a big part of that process has actually been around learning how to listen to my body again and to the messages that it's telling me, especially around what I put in it. So food and, you know, the products I use, like to clean my kitchen, to clean my skin, like all I've become increasingly in touch with what my body feels nurtured by and what it feels harmed by. But it's been this very, yeah, sacred process of reconnecting with my body and learning how to listen to it. And I think that's when I look back on the last 7.5 years of my withdrawal journey, like that's really sat at the heart of what's helped me to heal, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like, I think for a lot of people, that's also really at the essence of what the violation is, mm-hmm. that the medications do and the diagnosis does. It says that you can't trust your own natural inner process, that you have to surrender it to chemicals, to a doctor's opinion, to the expertise of the psychiatric industry, because you don't have the capacity to self-regulate. And then that gets taken away from people. But then once you step away from that and you discover that you actually can self-regulate and you can discover what you need, then you open up this incredible realm of potential. And it sounds like that's what you've tapped into. You've come through the other side. So now you're deeply, deeply connected with what you need, not with some authority outside of yourself. And you're deeply connected to what nature and your body can offer just as part of the natural healing process, rather than relying on the promises of these drugs and these products that are sold in the marketplace. And then that's what leads to a fulfilling and spiritual life.
Totally. And I love what you just said. All I'd add to it is that I think recognizing as well that all of the years of disconnection to my body that I lived with, and, you know, that looked like anything from just having all different kinds of struggles with like eating and body stuff, as I mentioned earlier. And so I got, you know, like all different kinds of diagnoses related to that. And yes, self injury and all different kinds of ways with like substances and all that. Those behaviors and those patterns were always pathologized, you know, especially with one of the labels I had, a borderline personality disorder. And I think recognizing too, that just as you were saying, we are taught to surrender trust in ourselves over and to turn that over to these authorities. But I think also recognizing that the pathologization of the disconnection that happens through these drugs is its own kind of really betrayal of the human spirit. And so as I've healed from the drugs and reconnected, I've realized like, holy cow, so many of those patterns of disconnect that I was trapped in for all those years that were called all these different kinds of mental illnesses were really like manifestations of just the impact that the pharmaceuticals were having on me, and not just psychiatric drugs, but also the birth control pill, which is a whole nother story, but I was on that for many years too. And it did the same thing.
So Laura, it's inspiring to hear that you've connected with yourself in this very, very deep way. It's taken 7 years for you to do, and it's still an ongoing process, but let's start with someone maybe who's taking psychiatric meds now. Let's think about, because I know your work is so much about educating and working with helping people come off medication. Let's talk about some of the things that people need to think about, some of the steps people need to take, and some of the things they need to prepare themselves to get into the process of starting this whole journey.
So as I healed, I became increasingly more passionate about taking my own experiences and learnings and using them to help others who were also thinking about or struggling to come off psychiatric drugs. And so for a number of years, I consulted with individuals and families about withdrawal. And then eventually, a couple of years ago, I was given the amazing opportunity through a family foundation who believed in what I was doing to launch a new nonprofit organization along with a small handful of my colleagues that we've called Inner Compass Initiative. And much of our focus has been on getting the Withdrawal Project launched, which is an online comprehensive hub for all things psychiatric drug withdrawal, essentially. And we've just launched actually in January. So we're really in the process of getting ourselves out there as much as possible.
And what is the web address for that?
So the web address for Inner Compass Initiative is www.theinnercompass.org. And the website for the Withdrawal Project is withdrawal.theinnercompass.org.
So how would people get started if they are on psychiatric drugs of some kind and they want to think about coming off?
Recognizing that the journey off psychiatric drugs doesn't start with the actual taper. It starts with preparation, with taking all the time you need to really think through, first and foremost, the beliefs that you're carrying about yourself and about these drugs, and to really spend time thinking about this relationship you have to these pills and how these pills have come to shape your sense of self and your relationship to your emotional and mental pain or struggle or so-called madness, whatever we want to call it. I think starting there is important, and just coming to it with a kind of curiosity and non-judgment as well.
I think that's really key, because what happens is, I think, you know, like we were talking about your own anger in your family as a 13-year-old, normal experiences get turned into symptoms. And so we say, oh, I'm having some anxiety, I'm agitated, I'm paranoid, I need the medication. And that's an example of the belief system. Well, actually, maybe those might be emotions that you're going through that you can actually figure out ways to navigate and work through. And they might actually be telling you something. It doesn't necessarily mean that your disease is, you know, giving you an episode or you're having a relapse.
Totally. And I think what happens with that clinical frame is that, at least for myself, I came to have this profound fear of my mind and my emotions. And that fear just increasingly disconnected me from those messages that my emotions were telling me, as you said, because all of my pain was, I now see it, that it was fundamentally political. It was a response to the world I lived in and to the stories I'd been taught about, like what it means to be a worthy human being. And so I think, yeah, part of this early process of preparing to come off, it has been in many ways about facing this fear of myself and like finding a way to let go of that and to just to reclaim the ability to trust in myself and to listen to myself. And that's actually where our name came from. Inner Compass is, you know, we get disconnected from this intuitive wisdom that we all have within us as human beings by not just the mental health industry, but our schooling system and our government and all these powerful, you know, institutional and corporate structures around us. They train us to not trust in ourselves and to seek to consume to turn our power over to, you know, professionals and services and this and that. And so it is about learning how to listen to yourself again and believe in yourself and trust in yourself.
Another piece is also the support piece, because often it's not just our own beliefs, but the people around us. Was that an important part of your experience? And also, it's one of the things that you're teaching people to look at the support piece of this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what I'd say is that my support system through the whole process was just so instrumental to my making it through, for sure. But none of us actually, especially in the early years, were very well informed about what was happening. We didn't. I certainly wasn't. And my family wasn't either. And by that, I mean, I never actually took the time to really educate myself very early on about the drugs I was taking. Like, you know, I was in the beginning still thinking that I had a chemical imbalance, and these were fixing my imbalance. I had no, I hadn't yet, you know, seen through the kind of marketing narrative to what we actually do understand about these drugs, which is that we don't actually understand a lot about them, but B, what we do understand is that they're psychoactive chemicals that quote unquote work by, you know, disrupting central nervous system function. And that might feel quote unquote helpful sometimes. And it does for many people. But so I think my family and I, they were unwaveringly there for me through it all, but none of us really understood what was happening for a while. So it was scary. It was confusing. I'm imagining that at points along the way, they probably worried, my God, has Laura made the wrong choice here? But they hung in there with me. And eventually, as I began to heal, like that's, you know, I also began to really educate myself and also help my family educate themselves about not just the drugs, but the diagnoses and the history of the DSM and all of that. And at that point, my support system, I think, became really, really strong.
And you mentioned, you know, nutrition and food, and a lot of people might be wondering, well, why does coming off of benzodiazepines have to do with the food that I eat? Or how is it going to help me with my lithium, you know, my diet? What would you say about that? Like, what is the role, do you think, of diet in all of this?
Well, for me, it's been everything. And I definitely think that there's no one, you know, one size fits all solution or approach to nutrition when it comes to healing from psychiatric drugs. But I can say for myself that I tried all different kinds of, you know, protocol, like elimination protocols and various, like, not diets for like weight loss purposes, but just for inflammatory, you know, to help with inflammation. And what I found through listening to my body over these years of experimenting is that what I think has helped my central nervous system and my body heal the most has been a very high fat, low carb diet.
You know, given what you and I have gone through, which I think has been like a trial and error process. Now the community has been through this trial and error process. We can hopefully give some advice to people to give them a head start. Like, hey, take a look at these things. What happens if you consider that maybe you have gluten allergy? Or what happens if you start to be more cautious about the chemicals in your home? Do you feel better? Are you not as fatigued? Are you less brain fogged?
Mm-hmm, totally. Yeah. And we actually have a section at the Withdrawal Project that we call Cope and Heal. And it's we have like a long list of withdrawal symptoms there, a long list of coping techniques that people have reported helpful for withdrawal symptoms. But we also have a section called Reclaim Your Body. I think that's what we call it. And we have some pieces that we've written on these very topics. And yeah, and I think viewing it as an opportunity, like an opportunity to empower oneself, because yes, it can be frustrating when you're really sensitive and you feel sick easily, with, you know, certain substances and chemicals, but it's also like an amazingly empowering thing, or at least it has been for me, to, like you said, you now know, if, you know, you can piece things together. And it is also forces us to kind of extricate ourselves from consumer society as much a degree as possible, which again is shows just how political all of this is, that these products were taught through advertising. Oh, your house is going to look beautiful, or you're going to look beautiful. You're going to feel great if you consume this. We now see we don't feel great. We feel sick, and we're going to take back our power and step out of this consumer loop. So I think the psychiatric drug withdrawal process is a kind of, it can activate a kind of political awakening. At least it has for me, which gets me feeling super powerful.
So you mentioned coping tools, Laura. What are some of the main coping tools that you see people finding?
I mean, there's such a broad range of strategies people have developed, and it really does speak to just the uniqueness of the withdrawal experience. You know, for some people, like intensely rigorous cardio exercise is literally what helps them survive the akathisia, whereas I have friends who can't even walk up a flight of stairs without setting off a fight or flight response in their body because their GABA system is like so injured from benzodiazepines. And so, yeah, I'd say, you know, I think beyond nutrition and removing chemicals and kind of detoxifying one's environment, which is quite a universal practice that I've seen in the withdrawal community, some of the more common, some of the more common things I've seen are, you know, just people finding ways to be with what's happening for them, whether that's breathing or meditation, like walking outside, taking a bath, you know, whatever it might be that allows a person to hang in there with what's happening to them. That general theme, I'd say. And then on the flip side of that, what also is incredibly important for many people, and it certainly was for me, especially in the darkest hours, was having a reliable toolkit of distractions from the present for when things just get too much. And for me, I think I probably said it on our radio interview back in 2012, but like South Park saved my life. Like, it literally did. And I would just watch episode after episode when I couldn't sleep. And of course, you know, one could say, oh, television is bad for sleep hygiene. But honestly, in the worst hours of my insomnia, it was all I could do to keep, to get through the night, was to distract myself from my mind by watching the show. So yeah, I think whatever that distraction might be for you.
You mentioned sleep. I think this is also probably a common factor for a lot of people, is really having to make the connections between getting good sleep and how they're feeling and taking care of themselves around their sleep as a way of avoiding that downward spiral into crisis. What are some things that you've learn and see that people do to help them sleep?
I mean, I think a lot of people have found that really thinking through like what they're putting in their bodies or what they're exposing their bodies to in the hours leading up to sleep is important. So, you know, like avoiding caffeine, avoiding screens, like you were saying, you know, avoiding bright lights, like really trying to remove as many stimuli as possible from within and outside the body.
Avoiding intense conversations with your significant other.
Yeah, totally. all those kinds of things. You know, interestingly, some people have found like acupressure pads to be helpful for them with sleep. Some people find taking baths before bed to help them. I mean, again, many people have to watch TV to eventually get themselves to sleep. And, you know, like a breathing practice of some kind, guided body scans. Some people have found those to be really helpful. Listening to podcasts, some people find to be helpful. I mean, I think, one of the things that you actually talked about, I remember hearing you years ago saying, is like what's the story you're telling yourself about it, the insomnia itself, and that you can get into a fear loop of like, oh my God, I'm not going to sleep, which just makes you sleep less. And so just like taking the expectation away. I remember you saying it, I don't remember where it was, but I'm just going to rest. I don't need to sleep. Just going to rest, and that's okay. I think many people find that to be helpful too. Just philosophically, I'm of the mind that this is a very individual process, and people have the right to make their own choices about how they go about it, but that choice is only truly possible if it's informed. And so, you know, I look back on my decision to come off very, very fast, and I remember thinking that 5 drugs in 5 months was like an eternity. And I see now that was actually very fast. And, you know, I was able to do it and make it through. But again, as we were talking about earlier, I had a lot of resources at my disposal. I had a lot of support. Like, I had what I needed in place to basically be a complete mess for like years, really. And so I think it's really important for people to take the time in advance of whatever decision they make to get incredibly informed about the risks. You know, and to recognize there's no way to know in advance if you'll be one of the lucky ones who just maybe has a headache for a week and is then good to go. But there's no way to know in advance if you'll be one of them. And if you're not one of them, it might mean 10 years of serious disability. So I think taking the time in advance to really think through the risks and to really think through, is my life set up in such a way where if I was gravely disabled by withdrawal for a decade, unable to provide for myself, like, would I be taken care of? I mean, even then I hesitate because I know many people who, at this point, the numbers just grow by the month, who, you know, thought that they could stop quickly and be fine, and they're dead. Like, their suicide is an increasing issue in the withdrawal community. So I'm cautious to, like, you know, yeah, I believe in an individual's right to choose, but I just think the risks are so profound, and I've seen so many lives so in such disrepair that I really think choice is only actually choice if you really inform yourself in advance.
I think we're also seeing that people get into really serious withdrawal problems, even if they've been on the drug short term. Sometimes people are having really, which is surprising to a lot of people, but again, it's about that informed consent and learning the information so that when you make these choices, you understand what the risks. Unfortunately, there's risks of staying on the drugs. There's risks of going off of them. It's a terrible position that people have been put into in the first place. And then they have to kind of make the best of a bad situation, just mm-hmm. do the best you can. I mean, and it's complicated because it's so unpredictable.
Yeah.
And that's why support and attitude and beliefs and all the different things that you do to take care of yourself are so important. And let's talk about the role of prescribers, because a lot of times people will tell me, well, you know, I want to come off my psychiatric drug, but my doctor won't let me. And I'm thinking, are you on probation or parole? But people have this attitude, and it's, you know, the attitude that so many doctors and general practitioners and psychiatrists have of, they're the ones who are responsible, and therefore they're the ones that are going to make the decision, because they're taking care of this disease that you have, and it's their job to do it the way that they've been told to do it. And that's a very difficult situation for people to be in, because it's, you know, it's frightening to begin with, but then to have to actually challenge your doctor or question your doctor, that's a very difficult thing for people to do. It's very frightening to actually claim enough authority to start to talk back to these kind of priest godlike figures in our society, of these medical experts. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, working with prescribers and some of the things that you've learned around that.
Yeah. And it's, I'm so glad you raised this, because it really is an essential piece of the puzzle. And yeah. And I relate a lot to what you just said. I mean, when I remember for the first couple of months that I was seeing my psychopharmacologist, he, I would ask him each time I saw him, you know, I'd like to come off, and he'd say no. And I'd say, okay. Like, it didn't even cross my mind that it was right. My body. And eventually it did. And I basically told him, like, this is what I've decided. But it took me a couple of months to kind of wake up from that indoctrination. And I think what you also touched on too, is the fact that we have set up a system, and I think it's much bigger than just the mental health system, but that doctors really have taken on, like, I am responsible for this person's life and death. And the fact that we've given them this power does make the matter of withdrawal much more complicated, because, you know, if there was no risk of liability, and if doctors weren't terrified of being sued and losing their licenses, you know, all of this would be far easier for many people. But the reality is, many prescribers are thinking about their own liability. And so,
yeah, because they don't get sued when people are damaged staying on psychiatric meds, right? They get sued when someone says, oh, you took them off, or they came off the drugs. That's when the society starts to judge it, but the damage done by staying on the meds isn't questioned.
Yeah. And of course, it's often called the mental illness itself. So, like, people exactly. aren't even seeing it. And exactly. yeah, I mean, I think strategically it makes, like, a lot of people find that. So I'll step back for a second, because there are different ways you can come at it. Some people, their instincts are telling them, I need to have a collaborative relationship with my prescriber here. I don't want to lie. I don't want to keep secrets. I can't do that. I can't put my head on the pillow at night. And so some people then really focus on thinking strategically about how can I get my prescriber on board with my desire to come off? And often that looks like really getting informed yourself about not just how to taper off in a manner that reduces risk as much as possible, but also just about the drugs themselves and understanding their pharmacology and, you know, and whether or not the drug is in a form that can be safely tapered, or if, you know, asking the prescriber to switch it to another form makes sense. And just the more time people take to put together a plan and to show their prescriber that, you know, listen, like, I've taken this really seriously. I've spent a lot of time educating myself, thinking this through. This for me is all about reducing risk and optimizing my chances of success. Like, can we partner together? You know, for some people that can end up being successful because the prescriber realizes, like, wow, my patient's serious here. They're not just going to do something reckless. Like, they're taking their time. On the other hand, some other people find, like, I just can't, I don't even, there's no chance my prescriber is going to be collaborative. I'm going to, you know, do this secretly and get support elsewhere. And
sometimes you just got to do that. That's the situation that you're in. And I think there has been a message, you know, that only come off your meds with your doctor's approval. But I think that's a dangerous message, because that can mean you could stay on your meds when you need to come off of them. And there aren't enough doctors who are supportive. And sometimes you do have to just take matters into your own hands, because it is your body and it's your life.
Totally. And I think recognizing that, you know, that of course can look to an outside observer like a very serious matter. Oh, you know, so-and-so is secretly stopping their meds. This is cause to lock them up. And so I think recognizing the risks,
the consequences.
Yeah. And to really think through, like, if I'm going to do this, you know, how do I, you know, take all the measures I can to protect myself and my rights. I think that that's an important thing. But yeah, I mean, when I came off, I didn't say this earlier, but my psychopharmacologist only agreed to let me come off of four. He told me I had to stay on the fifth one, Lamictal, and I came off of it secretly without telling him. And, you know, I felt guilty, and, you know, because I'd always been this good patient, but I had to do it. And I think many people do make that decision. And then, yeah, I mean, in other situations, some people kind of, like, I guess is kind of what my situation was. They don't actually have a very collaborative relationship with their prescriber. They don't really feel supported emotionally, but they have confidence that if they just tell their prescriber, this is what I'm doing, like, can you hang in there with me? You know, sometimes that happens and the prescriber basically just becomes like a prescription pad writer for you. And that's it.
One of the things I've seen that sometimes helps is if you go in with a plan, also if you go in with a family member and you can show them that there's multiple people that are involved that are supporting you. It's not just, you're not just doing this on your own, but you have go into the appointment with your mom or with your brother, whoever it is, and just have them speak up for you and say, yeah, we've all been working together on this. We support this idea. And then there are some magic words that I often see being helpful. And the magic words are, you know, thank you, doctor, for all the help that you've given me and for the medications, the usefulness that if you can find any usefulness at all in the medications, to acknowledge that. And then to say, you know, if it doesn't go well, I will certainly consider going back on the meds. That seems to reassure their prescribers.
That's a good tip.
What you don't want to do is go in with a copy of Anatomy of an Epidemic or, you know, something Laura Delano's, you know, podcast recommendation. You don't want to come across as being anti-medications. You want to be seen as being pro-health. You want to be seen as doing the right thing, not from an ideological stance or any kind of rigidity or bias, but just from, hey, I need to try something different here, because this isn't working.
Yeah. And I think just to add on to that, also putting together a plan for, you know, if things do get tougher, like, what else are you going to do? You know, I'm going to, you know, here's my plan. Like, I have these friends who will meet up with me. I'm going to get this kind of exercise. I have this meditation practice, like, showing your prescriber that you're thinking through, like, all the different ways you can help yourself if you do come up against difficulties. And in addition to, the, you know, quote unquote openness to go back on. I think just the more you can reassure your prescriber that you're being responsible and thoughtful and considerate in this decision-making process, the greater the chances that they'll work with you on it.
So if all of this sounds complicated, It is, which I think is why those of us who are doing this work emphasize the community aspect. There's a movement out there of people who are working on this because the medical system isn't providing pathways forward. It's not providing the support. It's not providing the ways of helping people who need to come off these meds, much less not get on them in the first place, because the medical community isn't providing this, that we're providing it for ourselves. And this is where the Inner Compass Initiative and the Withdrawal Project that you're doing are so important, because you're creating this hub of information that people can find each other and support each other. So tell us about the TWP Connect aspect of your work, because I think that's a really crucial part of this. It could be really helpful for people.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking about it, because it's the part of what we've built that I'm most excited about. So, yeah, I mean, as you said, there are tons of online spaces at this point where people can support one another to come off of these drugs and share experiences and all of that. But where I think we're still a bit in the dark ages is around in-person local community for withdrawal. And, you know, with so many thousands of us all around the world who are coming off or have already come off or who are thinking about coming off of these drugs, you know, chances are in every town and city, like there's at least two people who are thinking about this with the many millions of people on these drugs. So the question becomes, how do we find each other? And so we've built this platform called TWP Connect that allows people at all stages of the withdrawal journey, from just thinking about the idea of maybe coming off or reducing one medication, all the way to people who've been off for, you know, 10 plus years. Fill out a little registration form. It can be anonymous. You basically share a bit of information about where you're at in the coming off journey, what kind of needs you have, what your interests are around withdrawal. And then, our technology, like you tell our system where you're located generally, just like the town you're in. And then, you can actually search for other members based on geographical location and interest and needs. So you could say, I want to find five people within a 5-mile radius of New York, you know, of Brooklyn, who are 2 years off meds because I'm just starting the process and I want to get some mentorship from someone. So you enter those criteria, and then all the members who meet those criteria show up, and you can contact them via a message system through our website that takes you off site to your email. So we don't actually have forums or chat rooms. Like, we're not trying to replicate a social media platform. We're really creating this online tool to facilitate in-person connection. And so I'm really excited about the possibility of, you know, of people finding each other. And then in the months to come, we plan to share resources for organizing support groups and discussion groups and all of that. And we actually have the same platform over at the Inner Compass Initiative website that we call ICI Connect. And it's the same thing, but basically for anyone who's asking questions or thinking critically about the mental health system, because there are so many of us and power comes in numbers. And it really, when you think about just how profoundly transformative it can be to sit at a local coffee shop and have a cup of tea with someone and just connect through shared experiences. Like, that's the kind of thing. It's the kind of thing that could help someone not check themselves into the hospital that night if they're really struggling, or, you know, a potluck dinner with five people from your town where you just talk about how hard it is to be alive, or you have a fun, like, critical conversation about the DSM and, you know, these simple free connecting opportunities can be really transformative. And my thinking is, this is how we're going to really change things moving ahead, is at the grassroots. It's not by, like, fighting the system. It's by helping people in their own communities realize, like, we don't need the system. We have each other. But how do people find each other in the first place? And that's what our platforms will hopefully help to facilitate.
Laura, we're just about out of time. Give people the contact info and the website address for your work.
Yeah. So if you're interested in learning more about our nonprofit, Inner Compass Initiative, or in learning about, you know, getting a critical look at psychiatric drugs and diagnoses, you can visit us at www.theinnercompass.org. www.withdrawalproject.org. And if you're interested in the Withdrawal Project and our, you know, step-by-step companion guide to withdrawal and our connecting platform and our coping resources and all of that, you can visit withdrawal.theinnercompass.org. And you can be in touch with us by emailing hello@theinnercompass.org.
Laura Delano, thank you for joining us on Madness Radio.
Thanks so much, Will. It was great to be here and to catch up with you and to chat about these important issues.
You've been listening to an interview with Laura Delano. Laura is an ex-psychiatric patient who withdrew in 2010 from 5 different psychiatric medications after being on them for 12 years. Laura is the co-founder of the Inner Compass Initiative and its Withdrawal Project, which is an online hub for psychiatric drug tapering and withdrawal and community building. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.